Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Chris Bargoot. Welcome, Chris.
Good afternoon.
Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You came as close as anyone ever has, really.
Thank you. We're really happy to have you with us. Now, we start at the beginning, and you and I were both born in New York State, but at opposite ends of the state. So why don't you tell me about where you were born?
My mom was a little bit older and had a bit of trouble with my brother, and she was 38 when she had me. And so we had to go to a kind of a high end. And my father has told me that the only time he's ever had to borrow money in his whole life is when I was born. And because it was, my mom was expected to have difficulties, and it was like she was in labor for like 18 hours. And yeah, I was born in New York City in Beth Israel North Hospital.
And you've already told us that you had an older brother.
Yes. He passed away when I was a teenager, and it was from suicide. So both my mom and my brother passed before I was 18.
And how much older was he than you?
He was 2.5 years older than me. You know, I had a difficult childhood, and he was bipolar, and he was a good guy, but it's a difficult subject to broach just because it's sort of, I actually ended up being closer to Mennonites as a result of that, because I expected him to commit suicide based on what he had told me. This is when I was 15 and I went to private school in Pennsylvania. And so I was out in Northeast Pennsylvania, and I went to a school called Wyoming Seminary, which is in the Wyoming Valley, which actually has more people than the state of Wyoming. But the school gave scholarships to several Mennonite families who were traditional and didn't send their kids. And so the school would accept whole families and agree to if they had like 5 or 6 kids. And so I kind of got familiar with the Mennonites from that, as well as the fact that my mom was born in Switzerland and basically told me that we're not Catholic or Protestant in the traditional sense. And I like, well, why don't we go to one of the churches? And she goes, well, we don't have one in the area. And I'm like, I thought you told me New York's like the biggest city in the world. How could we not have that? And she goes, well, why don't we go down to Hershey Park? And I'll explain. And so I remember like that we went down there, and you know, it was really cool, but then we went right into the Amish country. And, you know, my first language is Swiss German and stuff like that. And, you know, I was vaguely familiar. I'd seen the horses and buggies before, but I had no idea. So that when we stopped on the side and went out and stuff like that, I realized that what we spoke at home, Swiss German, was very close, like 98% was what Pennsylvania Dutch was. And so I had some of the additional stuff. I did not say the Pledge of Allegiance in school, so I had to get a special exemption. My mom passed away when I was 8, just like a few days after I turned 8. But she had had a mastectomy, both, when I was 2, and she did not expect to make it. And so one thing she did, she treated me like I was the best thing that she had ever done in her life. And so every bit of confidence and self-worth I have comes from my mom, but she dedicated her last years to helping people. I would follow her around and would go feed people. It was the late 60s. She would pick up hitchhikers. She goes, oh, you're with me. If I was alone as a lady, but as long as I have kids, I'm just fine. And then sometimes she would pick up people who were stoned. And she was like, this is why you don't get stoned. And so I was like, oh, okay. No one had to really tell me these things. And so it was an interesting thing. She just was out there constantly serving people. We did, you know, like Meals on Wheels. We would go down to the Bowery and feed people there. And I was a kid and I would just travel along and help. And so I just had a vision of Christianity, I guess, that was you just pour yourself out to people. And that is very different because I went to a Catholic, like, grade school, after school kind of thing. And I was like, my German speaking God seems to be so much nicer than the English speaking one. And so I never found that German speaking God until, or that energy until I came to Portland Mennonite. So that's, for me, it was a very easy, I mean, it might be later in the interview, but it was a very easy place to adjust into.
I'm curious about your parents. Tell me a bit about them. How did they meet? Who was your dad?
Okay, so my dad is a Palestinian refugee. We are not too far from Bethlehem. Actually, if most people, they go read the Bible and they see these lists of towns and areas and they just sort of scan to the bottom because it's so long and they don't know the area. But the first town that accepted Jesus was Lydda, which is where my family is from. And if you look up, you said my last name, which starts with Bar, which is Aramaic. And so I am an ancient Hebrew. And my family had been worshiping in the same church, which was built by Constantine 1700 years ago. And we're the actual St. George. People are like, you know, it's because they see St. George this or St. George that. Actual St. George is buried. Now it's in Israel. But at the time, our family was forced out. My mom was born in 1926. And when she turned 18, World War II was still raging. And she went to Germany as part of the Swiss Red Cross and was a triage nurse. So she was making decisions just as she turned 18, whether people would live or die. And they would send her right into the middle because the Swiss were neutral. And at that point, she basically, from what I understand, what she told me was that, you know, she couldn't go back to being a small town farm girl. And she basically made the choice to come out. She originally went to Mexico, but later to the United States. And both of my parents worked at the United Nations. My dad worked as the executive secretary for the Saudis. So he was like second in command at the Saudi embassy. And my mom was a radio announcer. So one of the things being Swiss is that you learn Italian, French, German. She lived in Mexico, so she was fluent in Spanish. And she taught herself Russian. And so they would give her the news in English for 15 minutes. And she knew all the official languages at the UN. So she would do the news 6 times in a row. The UN had a tower. There was no internet, no even telexes and all that kind of stuff was still modern. And so she would actually give most of the diplomats of the world their news. And she would just do each language. And then they would give her a half hour break. And then she would do that once in the morning, once in the afternoon. And so my mom was kind of the voice of the UN. And my mom was like 8 or 9 years older than my dad. And as I said, she had me when she was fairly late. So she was like, you know, almost in her mid-30s when she got married, which now is considered normal. But back in the late 50s, you were on a clock if you wanted to have kids and you had reached, you know, 33, 34, you better be, you know. And so my dad was, you know, 10 years younger. And
so where did they actually meet?
At a UN party. So my mom is from Switzerland and Mennonite. My dad's from the Middle East.
So your mom and dad were both working for the UN
in New York.
And that's where they actually met.
Yeah, they met at one of the, you know, the United Nations is basically, we see diplomacy, but most of what really goes on happens after parties. And there's actually quite a scene there, you know, because it's a way of people getting diplomats to meet. And yeah, UN parties are pretty much probably like Hollywood parties. They're pretty, from what I understand, from what my parents have told me, they're a pretty raucous group. And, you know, the mayor of the city might attend or presidents of various countries. They're always, you know, it's a way of people who might be on the opposite side of the fence to meet them, meet their people that they'll have to work with in a neutral setting. And it actually does probably avoided a lot of wars that way.
So how did your dad actually get to the United States? You said he worked for the Saudi embassy. Was that?
Yeah. So my father was born in 1933, and he was made a refugee in 1948. He has a couple of older siblings who were taken to concentration camps and put into forced labor. He, however, was just about 15. And was starting his growth spurt, didn't have a beard. And so his sisters dressed him up as a girl because they were taking all the men and all the boys over like 14. And so his sister, they took cover in the church, and they dressed him up as a girl, and he basically wasn't taken. And so he became the man of the house at 15.
You say they were being taken by whom? If you can just...
By the Israelis.
This is when the Jewish people were given the state of Israel. Right.
Yes. So this was after the formation of the state of Israel. And there's something called the Nakba in Arabic, where 750,000 Palestinians were made homeless. And this happened in July. And basically, they came into the town and said, everyone has to leave. They took all the boys. And everyone else just had to be, it was a forced march up to, and if you ever been to the Middle East, where they live, it's at sea level, but Jerusalem and Ramallah are about 3,000 elevation up. And it was in July. And yeah, it was, he knew English, and he got a job eventually working for the American Embassy in Amman, Jordan. And then he actually got a scholarship at Manhattan, so a Catholic college in New York. And he came over to the U.S. and he had to say he was a few years older than he was, since all his birth records were destroyed. And so, you know, when we ask, when were you born, Dad? He has all these records from all these different years. But, you know, sometimes you have to make life work. So he came here, and we're from a well-educated family. And I guess I could talk about this. This is kind of fun. But in the Middle East, Christians often do the work that Muslims won't. So like historically, Jewish people, being a lawyer or dealing with usury money, was considered something a Christian wouldn't do in Europe. And so Jewish people, you know, would be the stereotype, but it often was because Christians wouldn't do it. Now in the Middle East, you have certain things like Muslims are not supposed to drink, but they're also not supposed to be inhospitable. So if a Christian offers a Muslim a drink, it's considered very bad manners to not accept it. So if you hire a Christian to do things, you can sort of get around it because it's actually a Christian who's asking. So therefore, if a Christian offers you a drink, it's considered by many people can get away with that religiously, you know, so it's kind of the hypocrisy and stuff like that. So that's my, you know, that's how my father, because it was the UN, and as I said, they were doing parties. And so that's how he got that job. And in the Middle East, also, there was a boycott on Israel. And one of my father's jobs was to make sure that goods that were exported from the United States to the Middle East were not made in Israel, which, you know, I don't know whether I approve of that policy, but that was what was being done. And yeah, my father was young and he was in college, and my mom was like almost 10 years older and, you know, handsome young man. And she was looking for a husband, and they met at a UN party, and that is that.
Wonderful. Oh, what an amazing story. Thanks for sharing that. I want to get back to you. So you were going to school in Pennsylvania. Where did you go to high school? Where were you by then?
So my mom, as I said, passed away when I was 8, and my father remarried 3 more times, and they were very, very stressful things, you know, in a matter of a few years. And I basically, we talked a bit about my brother, and I just basically knew that he would, there was just a lot going on. And so I wanted to be close enough to New York that I could get back home in like 2 or 3 hours. But far enough that I didn't have to deal with a lot of the stress. And so I said, Dad, I'd like, you know, so we found a place, and it was 125 miles from New York City, and I could Greyhound it. And so that's how I ended up at a seminary in Wyoming Seminary, Kingston, Pennsylvania. And it was a very good school, but it was very diverse, even though it was a Methodist school. But as I said, that's kind of how I got to know that Mennonite side, which my mother had taught me about. But, you know, she said, we're like this, but really modern. And, you know, when my mother had a way of emphasizing certain words, she emphasized the word modern. And so I knew we weren't like the Amish, but, you know, and so it was like at the school, I got along with the kids, and because I was curious, because I was like, oh, okay, were from the same, and I knew that my family had settled in Goshen, you know, not my mother's, but two or three generations before. So I know that some of the family had left Switzerland 150, 200 years ago. And I knew that, that I had American relatives who had gone, you know, and so it was kind of like, but I never met them and still haven't, but I knew that a lot of my Swiss family had settled and become part of the Mennonite community here in the U.S.
So when you graduated from high school, what was going to come next and how did you make that decision?
Well, my father was quite successful in New York as a, eventually he pivoted his connections at the UN to become an exporter. So he would take American cars, which were very popular in the Middle East because we had much better air conditioner units. You have to remember this is the 60s and 50s. This is, you know, it's like, and because women were not allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, they wanted big cars. You know, the more big families, big cars, air conditioners. That meant the American cars at that time were very popular. And my father did that, but you were asking about me, so I'll get back to me. I basically saw a lot of people who were worn out and unhappy, and I would take the train. So I would take the train because my mom passed, and I would meet him at work for several times a week. And the people on the train looked like they had been beat up by life. And I said, I don't want that. I know I could take over my dad's company, but I don't want to. If I only have one life to live, that's not the life I want to do. So I came out west. You know, another thing that's very thing, I am LGBTQ. And I'm born in 63. So by the time I was 16, 17, HIV was taking off. And I was in the epicenter of it. And I did not believe I would see 25. Now, I was a bit, you know, we don't talk sexually here, but I was a prude. And so I didn't do much, but people didn't know how it was transmitted at that time. And so I saw a lot of people, if not a lot, most of the people I had started to associate with when I was in New York were starting to die. You know, many people like, what did you look forward to? And so, you know, my mom had passed away, my brother had passed away, and now all my friends were passing away, and I was not even 20. And so the whole notion of career track, you know, I was in college and stuff like that, but I didn't, as I thought, go the way of my friends, I didn't see myself living to 25 or even beyond that. And so that is kind of part of my history where, you know, where people say, yeah, I was taken off the regular trajectory of life by that. And so I came out west, and as I said, I didn't expect to live all that long. And so I'm not a pleasure seeker, but I just wanted peace and quiet. I loved Oregon. I loved the green. I loved the coast. It reminded me of Switzerland, where I had spent a lot of time when I was young. My mom was going to raise me in Switzerland, and so I don't know, Oregon just felt like the right fit and it still does. So I love it here. So.
So when you said that you came west, you came to Oregon is where you came to.
I originally went to University of Colorado in Boulder because the school had a reputation of go skiing for 4 years and pick up your degree at the end. So I was like, as I said, I didn't think I would see 25. And I was like, I was a good student. And so I liked the idea of being outside, and it had a good psychology program. But I was like, I didn't realize that Colorado was so dry. You know, you see all these pictures of Colorado, and it's only really green and pretty like 2-3 months of the year. And I had said, you know, I like it out west here, but it has, in some ways, I like the mountains, but everyone just said, you need to go to Seattle. You need to go to, you know, the Northwest. So spring break, my intention was to go to Seattle, but I went through Salt Lake and then took 84 and then 5. And so I spent time in Portland and then I spent time in Seattle. And I said, no, I like Portland a lot more. It's a lot more real. And so I said, this is where I'm going to settle when I'm done. And that's what I did. So that's, it was, yeah, it was actually one of the best decisions I've ever made.
So you went to school in Colorado. Did you finish up there as well?
Yes.
And what was your degree and what were you thinking in terms of a profession or why you chose that field? Or
I was like a lot of people who choose psychology, they just want to, it's sort of like a liberal arts degree. You can take a lot of different classes. You know, I was interested in Jungian psychology and I was interested in the way people's minds work because I had seen so much. You know, I had seen, you know, in addition, I had seen some war, which was my summers in Gaza. It's just, I had seen humans, and I'd say as we started this, I'd seen my mother totally dedicate her life to service, even though she knew she was going to pass away. It just was very interesting to me how different people came to different conclusions. Like for me, when I went to the West Bank and stuff like that, I was surrounded by pure violence. I saw people being shot at, thrown, you know, just the worst. And that's how I became a pacifist. I just said, I think I have to choose a life where I, in my own actions, are authentic. And so I said, taking advantage of people being violent towards people, it wasn't so much a Christian thing, even though I had been taught it. It was just a human thing. It was a, be the person you want everyone else to be, even if they don't reflect that back to you. So I think at that point, you know, with all that else was going on, that was sort of a central theme of where I wanted to go in life, just to be the person. And it wasn't what other people were doing. It was just sort of, this is, you know, I want to be a good guy, and that's it, nothing more or less, and just sort of that, and that brought me out here. And
did you know what you were going to do with that degree in terms of making money?
No, you know, one of the things, my mom left me quite a bit of funds. Her father had owned a window and door making company, and they actually used Douglas firs that were here in Oregon. And the word for Douglas fir in German is Oregon. So you're saying you make something out of an Oregon, you're making it out of Douglas fir. And, you know, Europe had gotten rid of most of its old growth forests, you know, even back 150 years ago, there wasn't that much of beautiful old growth. And so making windows and doors, which is what they still do, they make these beautiful wooden, because the houses are mostly concrete because there's not enough wood, and far less than in the US. But then they use specialty, they make like the windows and the latches and the beautiful front doors. So you get the sense of what Switzerland or even Germany used to be. But you don't have as much wood. And so they wanted the best quality wood. And so my grandfather in Switzerland actually made his stuff using stuff that was from here in Oregon. So it's kind of a fun circle how I ended up here in Oregon.
So what year did you actually come to Oregon?
It's on your driver's license, 1985.
And what was the plan? What were you going to do?
As I said, I didn't think I was going to live. So you don't really make plans. You basically take jobs where you find them. My mom, as I said, left me some. So I took like a third of what she left me and bought my house, which I own now. And, you know, I just paid for it outright. And I just said, you know, as long as I have a roof over my head, that's one of the three or four, you know, I need food in my belly, a roof over my head. And those are two of the really basic things in life. And I, you know, I used my mom, what she left me, as a gift. And so I wouldn't say I'm a strongly directed. I've worked for the Federal Public Defender's Office. I've done a lot of paralegal work over the years, but I've never done the whole career track. Has never, you know, I think just my life in general, I never expected to be where I am right now. So, you know, I don't have that kind of ambitious, you know, make as much money as I can kind of thing that some people do. So
we're going to jump ahead just a little bit. How did you actually find Portland Mennonite Church? What's that story?
So one of the other interesting things is I was partnered with a man back in 1990, and we were in total together 7 years. And a few months into the relationship, he tested positive for HIV. And I needed to find a religious community that could accommodate us. And that happened to be the Unitarian Church downtown. You know, I wasn't an expert. I was like, it's more for him, but also for me. Just needed to be a place where, you know, a person who's going to transition, and it was, you know, it was slow and it was ugly. And so I stayed at the church there for a number of years, but it wasn't very satisfactory after that period, you know, spiritually. And I, you know, I would go to church maybe a couple of times a year and stuff like that. But, you know, I was in the market, but I didn't know. And then I was just sort of looking, you know, and there was a conversation that just came up to me. And, you know, I was just thinking, I said, oh, my mom was Mennonite. I know that she taught me, you know, I didn't have water pistols or anything. You know, I had a lot of the thing. I knew what the ordning was. We basically talked about self-discipline at home and stuff. It wasn't like a rigid kind, but it was just sort of like, you know, don't curse, always be kind to people, deal with your stuff. But, you know, don't let, if you wake up on the wrong side of the bed, that you don't have a right to take that out on anyone else. That's sort of the self-discipline part. And I just was like, you know, maybe there's something, you know, I always liked my German God. I lived in a society where Christianity, particularly in the gay community, didn't necessarily have the best reputation, it's honest. But I was brought up in a Christianity that I liked, and I had never really found it. And coming to Portland Mennonite, I was like, well, I really want to get this. So I was actually very, you know, I was like looking really forward to my first visit, but really apprehensive at the same time. And I came in just like literally a month after you guys had voted to amend the Constitution for gay marriage. And I was like, oh, well, isn't this kismet? And I was like, you know, I was like, okay, so you did decide on this. And then I read the letters, which were very personal letters, which was up on the PMC website. And I read that and I was just like really blown away by how I felt, even if the people didn't agree with where I was at, but everyone had really taken their time to think it through. And I just saw that as really healthy, regardless of where they, you know, I was like, you know, I don't want to join a church and say, well, I liked what you had to say and I didn't like what you, you know, I was like, I just wanted to be, but people had cut me, even if it wasn't the way I thought about it, but everyone really, it was, I felt just from reading those letters, a sense of community that was really affirmed. You know, I was like, it was a really healthy church and a really strong Christ-centeredness that wasn't judgy. At the same time, it was just like, we really love Jesus, and that calls us to be good people. And that's kind of how I had always thought of things. And I had never been in a community that was, that fed me that way. So yeah, being at PMC was a very easy fit. It was, I don't want to say love at first sight, but something pretty close to it. And I'm one of those people who can, once they make a commitment, like as I said, I came to Portland 35 years ago, once I said, I like it here, you know, and so that was my feeling about Portland Mennonite. And so, you know, people are like, oh, I remember going the first few weeks, you know, because there are people who are like, are you one of those people who go to a different church every week? And I'm like, no. Yeah. And I just said, you know, this is what I've been looking for. And so it's been a wonderful experience. You know, there's some issues, you know, I'm a person of color because of my Palestinianness. But, you know, there are some things that I look at, but I think it's a beautiful, I mean, just how many really wonderful people doing Christianity and having it mean something for them in their life. And yeah, love, love, love the church.
Well, we're out of time and we haven't even gotten to the pandemic, but I think that's okay because we stopped at a really good spot. So Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to share some of your amazing story with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. We hope you discovered something new and feel more connected to your friends at Portland Mennonite. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.